When this time approaches, it's just nerve-wracking. So during my prayer and meditation this morning, I swear I heard God saying to me, "You are going up there to do exactly what I planned for you to do. Now is not the time to become speechless." So with that, I'm going to begin my story. Once again, I'm Cliff. I'm an alcoholic. I was born in the state of Tennessee, right outside of Nashville, Tennessee, in the city of Smyrna at Seward Air Force Base. My father was in the military for 26 years. He retired as a senior master sergeant from the Air Force. And shortly after I was born, our family was relocated in Universal City, Texas, which is about 26 miles north of San Antonio. And a couple of miles north of the Air Force Base was a little town called Cibolo, and it was a mobile home community, and I grew up in a trailer park. So there's a good base for for the kind of upbringing that I had. So, I'm trying not to go all over the place. My childhood, at an early childhood, was a lot of fun, you know. I was a good little kid. I was a fun little kid, and I had a lot of fun with the other little kids. But, you know, as I started to grow, as I started to age, I started changing. Some natural things were starting to happen to me. I'll just open up and tell y'all that I'm homosexual. I'm gay. And I have been since long before I knew what little boys and little girls were supposed to do with the parts that they were born with. It's just something that was natural to me all the time of my childhood. And so in the late 70s and the early 1980s, my childhood was kind of rough, especially growing up in a trailer park in rural Texas. My father being military was very hard on me, you know, because apparently he knew what was going on. Nobody talked to me about it. My brother was a little redneck. He wore a 10-gallon cowboy hat and a belt buckle the size of a dinner plate. It was ridiculous. And all the ego that goes along with it. If anybody remembers anything about Texas in the 80s, giant belt buckles and huge cowboy hats were the thing to do, right? That wasn't me. It never was me. I did not want to play with all the little boy children in the neighborhood. I wanted to play with the little girls. I just felt naturally drawn to them. I liked what they did. I liked the toys that they had to play with. And I just had a lot of trouble fitting in with the other kids in the neighborhood. So I grew up, you know, doing a lot of sissy things, but I was naturally developing that way, you know. And let me tell you, it really was not a good place to be in the late 70s and early 1980s growing up that way to a military family in South Texas. I could have chosen a better career path when I was a kid, I'll tell you. But that's the way it was. And so, in short, you know, going through school and stuff, I didn't have any friends. I didn't have anybody that I could talk to. Nobody would bring up the subject to me about what was happening to me because the subject was taboo. Nobody wanted to be seen with me. Nobody wanted to be friends with me. Nobody even wanted to acknowledge that they knew who I was because all of us feared what other people think of them. And fear of what other people think of me was one of the roots of my alcoholism, because people-pleasing is a terrible thing to have to live up to, because you can't please everybody. For me, I felt like I couldn't please anybody. Felt isolated and felt alone. So I failed a lot of my courses in school because a lot of the kids would continue making fun of me, pick on me. Through middle school and early high school, they would, like, threaten to beat me up. "I'll meet you across the street after school." The word queer and faggot was thrown at me quite a few times. I didn't know what that meant. You know, I knew it was insulting in some way, but I wasn't aware of exactly what that meant. But again, everybody else knew what it meant, but nobody would talk to me about it. You know, why would they? Not even teachers or counselors. I mean, no one. So I felt isolated and I felt alone. So I found this passage that one of my friends wrote on Facebook, and it will give you like an idea of what my childhood was like word for word, okay? My life, kindergarten through 12th grade, the first 18 years of my life right here. The painful part of being a queer kid is not knowing that you're queer. It's in the not knowing. You know you're different from the other kids, but you don't know why. The other kids know that you're different, too. In fact, they never let you forget it. But no one gives you a language for it. No one gives you a mirror. And so you just sit there quietly being different, not fitting, trying to be invisible, and so you are truly alone. That's a hard pill to swallow because that basically describes the first 18 years of my life. And I never could shake it. And I was always taught in church that I was an abomination, that everything that I stood for and everything that I felt, I hadn't come out yet, by the way, but I knew what my innermost feelings were, and I couldn't shake them. So I was living in fear because the church taught me that what I'm doing is abomination, what I'm doing is unforgivable. And, you know, it just, it was scary for me as a child to think that I'm doomed to hell because I cannot control what I'm feeling. I don't know where it's coming from. God, please make it go away. It never went away. I would pray for a solution that would never come. And so it was truly heartbreaking. But anyway, after I turned 18 years old, I was working for an apartment complex as a landscaper. And one guy drove by. This is just a base story, by the way, of what my life was like, what led up to my alcoholism, okay? I was working as a landscaper for an apartment complex, and this guy drove by. And a nice-looking guy. His name was Joe. He was driving a bright blue Camaro, super sport. It was really cool. And I knew exactly what he was, and he knew exactly what I was. And I felt a strange bit of comfort talking to him. I was like, finally, there's somebody else that's just like me. Because up to this point, there was nobody in my high school or nobody in my neighborhood that was like me. I didn't have anybody to identify with. So when I met this other person, he became my first boyfriend. And I moved from the little trailer park in Cibolo, Texas, to San Antonio, where he lived in the city, right? So there I met some other people that were just like me, and I began, you know, to get comfortable with the whole thing. But repeatedly, the whole education that I had in church kept haunting me, kept coming back to me. You know, you've got to change. This is not right. So he was also an intravenous drug abuser. But you know what? That didn't bother me. It should have scared the hell out of me, but it didn't bother me because I took comfort in finding that there was somebody else like me, and I didn't feel alone. So I was willing to deal with it, you know. And I made a lot of friends in that small community. But up till now, I'm so dense and stupid, I'm thinking just this small secret society in a small part of San Antonio was where all of my people were. I had no clue that there were people like me all over the world at this point. But, you know, as I was saying, the education that I got in church kept haunting me. And I prayed about it a lot, and I still talk to God a lot. And I was like, I've got to get away from these people. So I called my aunt who lives up in Tennessee, middle Tennessee, about 2 hours from Nashville, where my dad's sister is. And I said, I need to get away from this lifestyle. Can I please come up there and live with you? And she said, yeah, come on. So I packed everything that I owned, or not everything I owned. I left behind everything I owned. I packed what I needed. And I got on an airplane by myself at 18 years old, and I flew to middle Tennessee, or flew to Nashville, and she picked me up and took me to middle Tennessee, where I would spend the next 2 years. Involved in the Bible, involved in the Pentecostal church, and I had a fantastic connection with God. I repented from my sins, and I was just so happy, and everything was going beautiful. This town is about as small as the trailer park that I grew up in, by the way, and it's in the mountains of Tennessee. If you're picturing the snake handlers and the venom drinkers, it was all over the place, you know, and I found out what holy roller meant. They've got these long slopes that run down the church, and people that fall out in the spirit would roll down and tumble down the little thing. And I thought, that's fascinating. That's not happening to me, but that's fascinating, you know. So I was buried in the Word of God. I was listening to gospel music. I was so happy with my relationship. But then for the next 2 years, I would do that. And I was 20 years old when my cousin Charles came up from Chattanooga, and he told my aunt, who let me stay with her, you know what, there's really nothing for Cliff here. Why don't you let me take him back to Chattanooga with me? So I was like, okay, that's great, you know, and everybody in my family is like all church going and everything's great, so I felt like I was in good hands. So I moved to Chattanooga, and I started working at a Pizza Hut. Now, mind you, at this time, I thought I had eluded the entire queer community, left them behind in San Antonio, in that little secret society that nobody in the world knows about, right? So dense. Oh, my God. So I start working at a Pizza Hut in Chattanooga where I met two girls, and they were lesbian girls, you know. And I thought, well, I don't know anything in the Bible that talks about lesbianism, so, you know, they're good friends or whatever. And I took comfort in knowing that there were two other people that shared the same kind of feelings that I did, but I thought it was okay, you know, whatever. So for my 21st birthday, they wanted to take me out to a nightclub. And I was like, okay. So my stomach started jumping to stuff because I'm about to do something adult, right? To this point, I hadn't drank, right? I mean, I'd tried a beer or two here or there or whatever, but I never was a drinker. But I went out to the club. It turned out to be a gay club. And these girls knew what was going on, but they wanted to surprise me. Well, they surprised me, right? Because standing before me was a crowd about the size of the one in this room, in this nightclub, and everybody was dancing and having a good time. But I noticed all of the genders were dancing together, like all the guys were dancing together and the girls were dancing together. And I thought, uh-oh, something's wrong with this picture. But it was weird. Once again, I took comfort in finding that I'm in a place where I fit, where there's other people like me, so I just dealt with it. And I had a good time. I was, like, watching people hiding in the corners, in the dark corners, just watching people. And this went on for some period of time because I kept going back to that club just to be around people that made me feel comfortable. And still hiding in the corners, I was terrified to talk to anybody because, you know, I had never been exposed to a group of people this size before that were like me. But I was still very surprised by it. So finally one day, a guy came up and offered to buy me a drink. And so I took a deep swallow and I was like, sure, why not? So he brings me a Long Island iced tea. Okay, I'd never had a Long Island tea before, but I tasted it, and it was so delicious. I just drank like half of it right there to quench my thirst, and I was like, wow. And I can tell you, it was like this, you know, the warm feeling of alcohol that goes down your esophagus when you get that. Okay, I got that right away. But the skin of confidence that coated me, like Pepto-Bismol, right? It just, all down me. I felt it, the commercial. It coats, it soothes. So after a couple of those, I started having a conversation with this guy who bought me a drink, who took me around and introduced me to some more friends. So I thought, this is really cool, you know, and I was having a good time, and I was talking to other people, sharing stories and things like that. And, It was an addiction, a different kind of an addiction, the addiction of being validated, the addiction of counting as something, enjoying myself, getting to talk to other people without being snickered at or shunned or rejected. And I thought, well, this is really cool. So naturally, I wanted to go back for more of that because I'd never had that before. So it's great. I've forgotten all about the church at this point, right? So in lieu of my relationship with God and the Word of God and Jesus, I decided to continue going to this bar and drink on a daily basis, meeting people, having a good time. It was my routine. I like the way Jerry B. talks about three stages of drinking, drinking out of social drinking, and then drinking out of habit, and then drinking out of necessity. Well, I was in the social part at this point. I would go to the bar early. I wanted to be sure to be the first one at the door because I wanted to know everybody that was coming and get ready for my little social butterfly thing. So I'd have a few drinks, and I was drunk by 6 o'clock. Ridiculous. P.M. The A.M. didn't come till much later. So I would go out to the bar every night and I'd have a few drinks. And I'd start making friends and stuff. And this became routine for a long period of time. And then it sort of became like a habit, like this is what, again, my routine is. It's a habit now. You know, I get off work, I'm going to go to the bar, have a few drinks, have a good time till about 11 o'clock at night, sometimes later, go back home, go to sleep, wake up, go to work, after work, go back up to the bar, have a few more drinks, and on and on and on. This went on for a long time. Well, eventually, I'm a person who gets bored very easily, so, you know, that wasn't enough for me. I wanted more attention. God, I was such an attention seeker. I must have annoyed that. But the lights went out in the bar on a Friday night, and all these people gathered around the dance floor, and I couldn't figure out what was going on, you know. So some of my friends took me up to the edge of the bar, and I saw this entertainer walk out onto the stage, dressed like in super high heels and leather, brick hair, makeup to die for, jewelry to die for, and everything. And she was dancing around and pantomiming to a rock song. I can't even remember what the song was, but I was so intrigued by that. And I thought, oh, man, that would be so awesome to do that. Be on stage where everybody's looking at you and clapping for you and cheering you. And not to mention handing you cash. They were handing her cash. I was like, you're having a blast and you're getting paid for it? I thought that was only for prostitutes, you know? So one of my friends told me that they had a talent night there. They have an amateur night, and so talked me into doing that. Well, fast forward past all that. I did amateur night for about a year and had a good time with that. But then I started making costumes. I started designing Vegas-type costumes. Bob Mackie was my inspiration for everything that I did. I absolutely love Bob Mackie. I love Cher. I love the Carol Burnett Show. He was responsible for all the costuming in those shows. And I wanted to be just like him, so I started creating costumes. Next thing I know, I'm starting to make costumes for other people and getting paid for it. So my popularity on stage grew really fast. I was a professional drag queen for 15 years. That was a lot of fun. Let me tell you, it was a colorful lifestyle. A lot of dark stuff comes along with that. I'll get into that in a second. But there's a nightclub in the city of Atlanta called Backstreet. It was a 24-hour Metroplex, a three-level bar. And I used to work at Backstreet at Charlie Brown's Cabaret. And how that came about was the little bar I worked in Chattanooga, we had guest appearances by other entertainers from around the tri-state area, or the tri-state, whatever, all around the southeast. Charlie Brown was the show director of Charlie Brown's Cabaret at Backstreet, and he came to Alan Gold's, the bar that I worked at, and did a guest performance with us and was impressed by what I was doing on stage and offered me a job in Atlanta. I'd never been to a city as big as Atlanta at this point. Chattanooga was the biggest place I've ever seen, and the biggest gay community I'd ever seen, by the way. So if the, yeah, oh, my gosh. I was so unexposed. Oh, my God. I didn't know what was coming. I mean, the stage was being set for me to lose control entirely. But Charlie Brown offered me a job at Backstreet, and my show director was like, you want to take my Cliffy from me? She called me Cliffy. And she said, you know, I can get anybody in Atlanta to work at my cabaret, but I want her. And Michelle says, well, Cliffy, what do you think? And I was like, Atlanta? Are you serious? Sure, I'll do it. I'll do it. So within a short period of time, I moved to Atlanta, where Backstreet, by the way, was one of the most popular night spots in the entire Southeast. Movie stars and recording artists used to come there. I had met Bill Paxton in person there before he passed away. Alanis Morissette, Toni Braxton, Grace Jones, Elton John, so many people came through those doors, and it was just a wonderful place to be. Backstage with the other showgirls and stuff was a lot of cocaine and a lot of meth. And me wanting to be a part of everything that's going on was talked into doing cocaine for the first time. At this point, just heavy alcoholism was all I was into, but then I did cocaine one time. Woof! Unstoppable. I felt like super bitch. I was like, wow, this is great, man. This is really awesome stuff. And I felt this power. I did cocaine because I liked the effects of it, and it made me feel good, just like alcohol. Alcohol made me feel confident and happy. Cocaine made me want to keep on going and keep on drinking, because this party is never going to end. So that would go on for a while. And then I got into, if this is a singleness of purpose meeting, I apologize, but drugs are a part of my story too. Alcohol is what nearly killed me, but I'll get back into that. But I was into cocaine and drinking alcohol very heavily, and since it was a 24-hour bar, sometimes I would be there for like a day and a half, 24 to 72 hours, right? Sometimes 2 days, sometimes 3 days or whatever. Well, eventually the fad of cocaine would sort of wear off in that community, and meth started to take over. So when I would go around looking for cocaine, they'd be like, oh, girl, that was so 5 minutes ago. Try this, you know. So I tried meth, and let me tell you, it's like cocaine on cocaine. It was so powerful, and it was so ridiculously crazy. And so I started using meth and drinking alcohol. There's that roller coaster, because alcohol is a depressant. It calms you down or whatever. Well, meth jacks you up. So when I would do meth, I would be like, on to the races, you know, and I'm still drinking. But eventually the meth would wear off and the alcohol would start to take over, and I'd be like, oh, I'm tired. I need to do another hit of meth. So I'd do another hit of meth, and then I'm back up again, and then back down again, then back up again, then back down again. Sometimes I would be in that club for 4 days straight, no shower, no food, just alcohol and meth and partying. Well, it got to the point to where I was so desperate for meth that I started stealing from that club that I was working at, right? Because I took a second job working as the person that collects the entry fee when you walk in the door, the cover charge, you know, next to the security bouncers. And so I was pocketing some of that money, sometimes $600-$700 a night for entry fees in order to buy drugs with. And that went on for a while. And the owners, I believe that they were kind of mafia-oriented, so they probably knew what was going on but allowed it to go until it was so obvious and I was becoming so obnoxious that they had no choice but to confront me about it. And they said, we caught you on pinhole camera stealing money from the cash register, so we're going to have to ask you to leave. And I thought, oh, well, I've lost my job sitting at the front desk, but that's cool. I can do it. I still got the show. I'll be here Friday night. They said, no, you won't. I need you to go upstairs to the dressing room and clean out all of your belongings. So in an instant, because of the choices I made, my dreams were shattered. You know, everything that made me so happy was being taken away from me in an instant. So I hung my head low, and I packed up all of my stuff. Some of it got destroyed because I was moving it quickly. And I put all my stuff in my car, and I drove home geeked out in the middle of midtown Atlanta traffic. One-way streets all over the damn place. Oh, my God. Being drunk and jacked up on meth at the same time, the streets of Atlanta is no place to be, but where else is the crackhead going to go, right? So I went home, and I spent a couple of days unemployed, scared, not knowing what to do. I was living in the Virginia Highlands at this time, beautiful place, and I could afford it because of the money I was making doing drag shows, but I was wasting it all on meth, cocaine, and alcohol, so I wasn't able to keep my apartment there for long. But I decided one day, well, I can't just sit here. I'm going to find a club to go to. And there is, if any of y'all are familiar with stories about bathhouses in the 1970s, there is one in Atlanta. And it's labeled as a gay men's social club, but it's a clothing optional social club. I'm going to get real personal here, but not too disgusting, okay? It's called Flex, and I decided I was going to go check it out and see what it was like, you know. They don't serve alcohol in there because there's a lot of swimming pools and, you know, equipment like that that, you know, they can't serve alcohol in. And people aren't wearing clothes, so there's no glass allowed in there or whatever. But there's lots of meth and lots of cocaine. So I would spend a couple of days there. It was also a 24-hour place, too. So I would spend a couple of days there, you know, geeked up and having some fun. And I don't know if a lot of y'all are familiar with what effect that methamphetamine has, but it fuels sexual energy out of people. It's like Viagra on steroids. It's ridiculous crazy, right? So I found myself, you know, going to this club where other people were like me and having some good times, and I was having a lot of sexual urges, and I encountered a lot of risky sexual behavior with a lot of different men. Sometimes several men at one time. And, you know, it was just fun. I could be funny. I could be pretty. I could go to bed with people. I could party. I could do drugs. This is the life, man. This is so much fun. And, I started losing weight, started getting really sick. And, a friend of mine asked me if I had ever been HIV tested. And I was like, no, but whatever. You know, it's not that or whatever. Well, I went to the doctor and I had my blood tested, because I was having uncontrollable bowel issues and fevers and weight loss, and this was in 1995, and I couldn't understand what it was. And the doctor came back in with my results after I waited 2 damn weeks for them. That's back when you had to wait 2 weeks, and it was a nightmare. But she said, Mr. Taylor, you positive. That moment of silence that I just presented to you was exactly what happened to me in that doctor's office, because I thought, I felt these butterflies go all through me, and my chest froze, and I just heard for the first time 3 letters attached to my name that I never thought I would hear. You are HIV positive. So I thought, oh my God, my life is over. All I could think of was, I'm going to die. What am I going to do? Because, you know, coming from Ryan White's time in 1985 when AIDS was first discovered and seeing all the devastation worldwide that this disease had on people, all I was left with was, what's going to happen to me and how am I going to go? You know, and then the doctors was like, well, you are in pretty bad condition. You're very close. In fact, you're teetering on the edge of being full-blown AIDS, which means you don't recover. You don't come back from full-blown AIDS. It's a syndrome in which your immune system has completely shut down. People don't die from AIDS. People die from complications like the flu, the cold, toxoplasmosis, pneumocystis pneumonia, whatever other, the common cold, just common diseases. AIDS simply means is that your immune system is shut down and does not work anymore. Well, I didn't have full-blown AIDS, but I was pretty high up there on the risk level. So they put me on experimental medications. And I was one of 13 people in the country that went to this clinical trial in Atlanta. And there were 4 medications that they had me on. I had to spend 4 days there in the study with IVs in my arms, and they checked my blood round the clock and stuff to see how I was reacting. Well, it turned out one of them caused me some liver damage, but the other three wound up being approved by the FDA. And because of the approval, I mean, because of my participation in the clinical trial, I now, for the rest of my life, will be receiving my medications for free. By the way, I stand before you HIV positive, however undetectable for the past 13 years. I'm at the point now. Thank you. I'm at the point now to where I can no longer transmit the virus to another person, unless it's a blood transfusion, but they won't allow me to do that anyway. But I'm very lucky to have escaped that part. But, you know, so at that point when I tested positive, I thought, well, you know, it's a lot of the sexual behavior has got something to do with it. Of course, you know, I can't tell you who infected me. And more shamefully, I can't tell you how many people I infected. I have no idea. But I went on carelessly, and that's just the raw truth about what I went through. My desperation to fit in with other people nearly cost me my life. So anyway, I dropped cocaine and methamphetamine. But alcohol, what's the point? Everybody drinks, right? So for the next many, many, many years, I would continue to drink alcoholically, still go to the clubs and drink alcoholically, till it came to the point to where I was basically too tired every single day to go to the club. So I started drinking alone at home. Plus, I was becoming highly annoying. You know, when a person is constantly drunk, they start acting stupid. Even the people that used to like you decided, like, we got to get away from this dude. Here comes that vulgar Cliff dude. So I spent a lot of time isolating, probably for about 15 years isolating. My alcoholism stretched about 37 years. So I continued to drink alone, and my doctor, who I originally got my HIV drugs from, had been my doctor for, I don't know, 20-some years, and he kept telling me that I'm drinking too much. And I was like, I'm really not drinking that much. He goes, well, how much do you drink each day? And, of course, I said, a couple of beers. The truth of the matter was, daily, for almost 10 straight years, I was going to Total Wine and Spirits or Bullock's Liquor, and then buying one of those big handles of vodka, because the cheap stuff is only like $10.12. And then I used Simply Grapefruit was my mix. I liked Salty Dogs, and I liked Greyhounds. So I would go every single day and spend about $15 on alcohol and on liquor and juice, right? Drinking in the morning to stop the jitters so I could go to work. Forcing myself to get through an 8-hour workday at my retail job. I worked at a fabric store. I've been in fabric and textiles my entire life since I started that drag career. That's what got me into fabric. I found that I have a real talent for knowing how to sew and custom tailor. I can make any one of you women a wedding dress in the afternoon. So ask me for my card later. the constant drinking every single day wants to calm my nerves. Then I go to work, I'd make it through work, but immediately when I got home, I went straight for the vodka. My routine every day at home was to make a vodka and grapefruit, sit down, turn on Judge Judy. I never miss Judge Judy, right? And then, you know, catch a nice little buzz, and then go up to my room and just lay in the bed and watch TV and drink until time to go to sleep. Sometimes I'd sleep through the whole night, sometimes I wouldn't. I would wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning with the jitters and the shakes. That was really, really weird and difficult. I only had one blackout episode. I remember specifically. I was at the point where I was drinking so much that I could no longer stand up to urinate, so I had to sit down to keep from, like, falling over, right? I remember passing out, sitting on the toilet, and I fell forward, and I hit my head on the marble countertop corner and cut my head wide open through the brow bone, and I remember just waking up enough to watch my blood just jetting across the carpet. And the first thought that went through my mind is, oh, my God, my roommate's going to kick my ass when she sees this. It's terrible. But, yeah, drinking every single day for years and years and years until my doctor finally said, you know what, you know I don't believe a word you're saying about how much you're drinking. Your blood work is showing different. Your triglycerides are through the roof. The ammonia is building up in your bloodstream. You're losing, I don't know, I was less than 90 pounds when I first went to detox. I'm 140, I've always been skinny, but less than 90 pounds, I think I was 87 or 88 pounds. But he said, if you're just going to kill yourself by drinking alcohol, I see no further reason to continue your HIV treatment. There are people out there who are desperate for your medications, and you're going to kill yourself drinking anyway, so why don't we just forget the whole thing at this point? That almost scared me straight. it didn't quite scare me straight because I didn't believe he was being serious. So he never did stop my medication, but I promised him that I would cut back my drinking. Like we can do that, right? So I got to the point to where, you know, I had to stop drinking. I could no longer perform my job. And I went to my boss at Joann Fabrics and I was like, "Lenny, I have to talk to you, sir." He said, "Please don't tell anybody this." He said, "But I'm in bad shape. I've got a drinking problem." And he just busted out laughing at me. He goes, "Cliff, everybody knows you have a drinking problem." It didn't occur to me that I stank like a brewery every day I went in there because I'd become immune to the smell because it's the way I smell all the time. But other people, I never paid attention to when they went, whatever. I just thought, whatever. It didn't occur to me that everybody knew about it, and I thought that they didn't. This is the story that we tell ourselves because, see, I'm smarter than everyone, right? So he said, "I tell you what," he said, "you go get yourself whatever help you need. I don't understand it. I don't understand how it works. I don't understand where it comes from. But you need help, go get the help. When you get back here, I expect 110% out of you, and I'll accept nothing less." So I was like, "Thank you." I had hours saved up from paid time off for vacation because I was one of his managers. I was in charge of the home deck fabric department. I had over 800 fabrics, and that was like 75% of our business. So I had a very important job, right? And people depended on me. So I went to Ridgeview, and I spent only 4 days in detox. At this point, I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous yet. I mean, I did, but that was something that happens to people like way up in the mountains or something, you know. So I did 4 days of detox, you know. And I didn't really know why I was there except, you know, just to get better. I didn't go there with the intent of getting better. I went there with the intent of not getting any worse. Because as time passes, you gradually learn to live with the way things are. So with this every day and with the bathroom problems I was having and all that, I was learning to deal with that, you know. And I thought, this is the way it's going to be. I can deal with it. So I spent 4 days in detox, and I started eating healthy, and I put on a couple of pounds, and I felt great when I got out. Hey, nirvana, I can go home, and I can have a drink now, and I can do it like I'm supposed to, right? I did not even open my luggage when I got home from detox. I went straight to the kitchen sink where I knew I put a bottle of vodka before I left just in case I freak out, and I was freaking out the whole time, right? So I made myself a drink. Now, my friend Joyce, she's 74 years old now. Her husband died of alcoholism after they were married for 37 years, and she had a pretty bitter taste about alcoholics. But when I first started working at Joann, she got hired the same day I did. You know, and we became best friends. We worked together, and she watched me decline over all these years. Her husband left her with a lot of debt, and all she had was Social Security, and she put away a couple of dollars each Social Security check towards retirement. She had about $5,700 saved up. My copay for my detox was over $5,000. And this beautiful woman, trying to save my life, took $5,000 out of her Social Security savings and paid for me to go to detox. This is how I made good of it. When I came out of detox, I started getting drunk that first weekend. She also bought me my first smartphone on the way home from Ridgeview. I've only been on smartphones for 6 years. I'm way behind the times on that. But when it came time to make payments back to her, I was trying to navigate my smartphone. And she said, you know, "You can figure out the phone later. It's smarter than you are. Use my computer." So I went to the computer and I pulled up my bank account, and all the transactions I made for that weekend popped up on the screen. Total Wine and Spirits, Bullock's Liquors, Publix Wine, and da-da-da-da-da. And she became infuriated. She's Scottish-Irish, by the way. She's from Chicago, too. So she says, "Get out of my house. Leave my home. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to see your face." And I'm like, "Joyce, I'm sorry. I'm sorry." She goes, "I don't want to hear it." I dealt with that for my husband for my entire marriage, and he died on my kitchen floor. "If this is how you thank me for helping you, I need you to leave my house. Go away." The only somebody in the world who cared about me is throwing me out of her life. I had no family or anything. By the way, my parents had already passed years ago. I'll tell you about that if I have time to anyway. But she was throwing me out of her house, and I was begging her and pleading with her. I said, "I'm sorry, I will try to do better. I swear to God I won't drink again." She goes, "Okay, I believe it when I see it. But for now, I still need you to leave my home." So I left with my head hung in shame because this nice elderly, I'm not going to call her elderly because she'd kick my ass if she knew I said, this older woman who had given everything that she had for her future on the line to try to help this little sissy out, and I didn't make good of it, man, that was a shame I don't ever want to feel again. But that's when I decided on August the 17th, on August the 16th, actually, I wasn't going to drink anymore. I'd already drank that morning. August 17th was the very first day that I went without a drink for the entire day, and that was in 2015. So in just a few days, I'm going to be celebrating my 7-year anniversary since I've had a molecule of alcohol in my body. And I'm happy to report that Joyce is now my best friend in the whole wide world, and I'm going to be taking her on a cruise to the Bahamas October the 1st. She deserves that, you know. So that was what it was like. That's what happened. Let me tell you what it's like now. I went to my first AA meeting where Damon was speaking of Nancy Foster. I went to my first AA meeting at Cornerstone at Kennesaw United Methodist Church. And that's where I met a couple of people, you know, and actually my very first sponsor. But I only went to that meeting once, and then a few days later I decided to go to another one. I went to Mars Hill Presbyterian Church, where the meeting is called the Saturday Night Special. That's where I met Miss Nancy. And Nancy was the first person that I actually made friends with in an AA meeting, because my picture of AA was a bunch of grumpy old men sitting around telling war stories, you know. I didn't have any idea what this program was about. But, you know, it was really cool the way that people shook my hand and welcomed me. Because, you know, hey, I fit in, but it's a different way to fit in, but I'm fitting in. This is pretty cool. So that sort of kept me coming back. Then they started talking about God. And I was like, I was like, no, we got to find another way. Because, see, I already did the God thing before, and I ruined that. There's no way that God's going to take me back. Because all I could think of was, you know, your life flashing before your eyes. The entire life of just nastiness that I was involved with was flashing before my eyes. And I thought, there's no way that God's ever going to forgive me and take me back. But then another Christian gentleman that was in that meeting said, you know what, if you'd read that Bible and paid attention more clearly, you'd see that it says, for all people have sinned and come short of the glory of God. You know, and then he also said, you know, do you remember the passage where it says God did not come to call righteous, but sinners to repentance? And I was like, okay, well, it started to make sense to me that God is made for people like us. You know, the sick and the suffering. If I was righteous and I was a stand-up man and didn't need God, there'd be no reason to have him in my life. He's here for the people that need help. So I stand before you today, once again, a Christian gentleman, just am just covered in the love that God has to give every single one of us. God loves me for exactly who I am. And working these 12 steps and, you know, coming to know myself as a person and the reason for all the things that I did, I'm really happy with my life. The 12 steps, one, admitting powerless over alcohol. I sort of always knew it, but I just sort of like pushed it aside and tried to forget that it was ever even there, because I didn't want that to stop me from having the good time that I was having. Fear of losing what I enjoyed was one thing that, you know, kept me from admitting powerlessness. But I finally did. Coming to believe, I've always believed. I just threw it away and decided to go a different direction for a while. God never moves out of the spot he's in. We step out of the light and go experience the world on our own. We're exposing ourselves to all those things out there when we step away from God. He is ever protecting right where he's at. He didn't move, I moved, right? Came to believe, got that down. Turning my will over to God, as I understand him, was a different story. It was a little difficult for me because I didn't quite understand what that meant. But here I am with my sponsor. I believe in God. Let's just go. What's next? Step 4, complete and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Oh, Lord. There wasn't another, this is kind of an ego thing to say, but I don't think there was another amoral soul that was worse than I was at that time. At least I think a lot of us feel that way about ourselves when we come in. We're the worst person in the whole wide world, you know. But every one of us are individual and different. But I went ahead and I confessed everything that I'd been through, you know. And, you know, that was really difficult for me to come out with it. I conveniently left some things out, you know, because there were some secrets I just didn't want to talk about. So it would take a little while before the steps came to be effective in my life. But I did the 12 steps. So talking to God, to myself, and another person about the exact nature of my wrongs, that was pretty enlightening. You know, it was like God's way of putting a mirror in front of my face so I could see myself clearly. You know, and then when I saw myself clearly, I wanted to turn around and run like hell, because I was not a pretty picture to look at. I couldn't stand my reflection in the mirror. So that was difficult for me, but it was freeing to a degree. And then 6, removing all my character defects. well, God, where do I begin with that? Because my whole life is based on character defects. Everything was based on fear, dishonesty, resentment, you know, anger, you know, rejection, whatever. Everything that had happened to me, I treated other people the same way because I just thought that's the way the world works, right? But I prayed to God to please remove my defects of character. And then I learned that in my own way, I figured out what shortcomings were. Shortcomings is like when a character defect presents itself to you, you have a choice of going left or right. It's a fork in the road. You can either surrender to the character defect and fall miserably to it and then have to come back to God to ask for help, or you can take God's path the right way, refuse the character defect, ask God for help to get through it, and then pick it up and move on, right? So there's step 6 and 7. 8, making a list of people that I had harmed. Well, step 5 really helped me out with that because I listed all the people that I had harmed, including the people that I didn't harm but that harmed me, you know. And I have to make amends to those people that I had hurt along the way, because there's no way that I can stand here and be a man of God and just leave that wreckage behind for other people to marinate in, because I really stirred up some sewage back there, right? So I got to turn around and go tell those people exactly what I did. I want to know exactly how it made you feel. What can I do to make it right? And did I leave anything out? That's very important to do that, because that affects the way that they show up for their brothers and sisters as they move through life. If somebody like me leaves a bitter taste in their mouth, that just leaves them a little bit more reluctant to be trusting of people and to open up to people. So I've created a situation for somebody else. I have to go make that right, right? So there's steps 8 and 9. Step 10, continuing to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. The word promptly is put in there because if you wrong somebody and you don't go and fix it right away, you're, again, leaving them to marinate in it and their thoughts about it and their opinions about you and about people like you. It just infects everything around them. So you have to be prompt about it, you know. And it also teaches you to recognize when you're about to be wronging somebody again, so you can learn to avoid those situations. 11, prayer and meditation. Oh, man, I never thought that meditation would really be a good effect in my thing, because I can't sit still for 5 minutes. But meditation for me is so extremely important, because when I stop and I think about, actually the book gives us instructions on how to meditate. It says, when we, upon awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for today, and here we ask for God's direction. When I wake up, I know exactly what my day's supposed to be like. But I also think I'm going out the door. I know what to do. I'm going to take charge. I'm in danger of screwing it all up. I have to center myself and say, how can I bring God into every situation that I'm dealing with today? And when I sit down for at least 10 minutes and I calm down and I think about that, the right answers come, and suddenly the plans that I had to fix things are not my plans anymore. You know, I just learned to go with it, and then because I have no control over what's going on out there, that situation around me is changing constantly, so I have to be prepared to bring God into that situation. So therefore, rather than trying to get my crystal ball out of the shop, I just simply do what God tells me to do, you know? And that, it's just, I'm in so much less danger of worry, excitement, fear, resentment, all that stuff because of that. So, and then step 12, being of service to other people. One of my good friends, Gregory, who came to another AA meeting, it was his home group, saw me after a couple of years of being sober and liked my energy. He said, he came to me and he said, why don't you quit your job and come to work for me? And I knew he worked for the recovery program. And I was like, but Gregory, I don't know anything about working in recovery. He goes, are you sober? I said, why, yeah, I've been sober nearly 2 years now. Do you know how you got that way? I was like, yeah. He goes, well, that's enough for us to begin with. And I was like, but Greg, I have a career at Joann Fabrics. He goes, Cliff, you have a job at Joann Fabrics. If you want a career, you have to trust me. I believe that you can be a great help to a lot of people. So I was like, okay, so I quit everything I knew for the past 15 years, and I went. And so for almost 6 years now, I've been working for Alana Recovery Center. At first, I worked in sober living, taking care of gentlemen as they came out of detox centers. Most of them were heroin and meth addicts. To this point, I had never really seen heroin before, but now it's at the forefront of everything I deal with. Never done it myself, thank God, because I probably would have loved it, and I wouldn't be standing here before you today. So yes. So to conclude this whole thing, Those 12 steps that are written on the walls in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're like little paragraphs. It's a whole lot of stuff to remember. So the way I look at the program now is this. The 12 steps are a mirror designed to show me what needs to be changed about myself. And the 12 principles behind those 12 steps are single words that are much easier to remember than those paragraphs, right? So now, instead of working the steps, I am simply living the steps. You know, I'm no different than I was when I'm a child. I stand before you happy, sober, gay as I can possibly be, secure in the knowledge that God loves me for exactly who I am. And when I stand before God on Judgment Day, I alone have to answer for myself. I'm not going to have a bunch of friends behind me saying, "We got your back." I have to stand by myself in front of Him. And I'm confident in who I am today. And the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous behind each step are, one, honesty, most important one of all. If you can't be honest with yourself and honest with other people, you may as well stop, because you will go no further. This program is based on rigorous honesty, right? As I hope that my rigorous honesty wasn't a little bit freaky for some of you people. Imagine being in my shoes and physically going through it. So, hey, honesty. Okay, hope. All right, hope is coming to believe in a power greater than yourself. Well, I already believe that, but now my job is providing hope for other people. If you're still breathing, there's hope. If you're suffering right now, but you're still alive to tell about it, there's hope. If I ever hear the word hopeless, I attack. I'm like, that is such BS. You are not hopeless. I was at the end of my rope, at the edge of my life, and somebody provided me with hope, you know, by explaining to me that God loves me exactly for who I am. So hope is a huge thing. Faith, turning your will and life over to the care of God. When I finally understood what that meant, I know that God's will for me is actually living these 12 principles. This is what a good person is supposed to be. Honest, hope, faith. Courage to look at myself and see what has to be changed on a daily basis, because my life doesn't stop when I finish the 12 steps. My life begins with the 12 steps, right? Integrity, that one stands alone. Integrity is, for me, doing the right thing when nobody else is looking. Okay, I can tell you that I'm honest, and I can tell you that I'm this, and I can tell you that I'm that, but on the inside, I'm the only one who knows the truth. I can only say this to you, and maybe you'll believe it, maybe you won't. I'm the only one that knows what's right, and I have to face God with that, so I have to live with integrity. Willingness to learn and willingness to help other people. You know, that's where the grace of God that saved me, I have to be willing to share that with other people. And I have to be willing to learn as the world changes. I have to be willing to change with it and still bring God into everyday activities, right? Humility. Humility for me is like being thankful for the basics that I have and understanding that the perks that you get in life are simply gifts. They can come and they can go. I'm very humble. And the fact that, first of all, I'm standing here alive today when I should not be, you know, with only 30% liver function, you know, and a history that should have killed me on so many occasions. I'm very humble in the fact that God saved me, you know, and because I don't deserve it. I don't deserve it. All right. Brotherly love. Making amends to your brothers and sisters, you know, righting the wrongs, and then spreading love from one person to another, being willing to help them. Discipline. Perseverance. Perseverance is another one of the words that are used for the 10th principle. Discipline and perseverance. Don't give up. Keep going. The 10th step promises talk about we've ceased in fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for even by now, sanity will have returned to us. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it. It's from a hot flame. We find ourselves in a place of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. That sounds like a pretty safe place to be, doesn't it? But there's a warning that comes in the next paragraph. It is easy to rest up on our spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. What that means to me is I'm satisfied with what I've learned. I feel that no further effort is necessary. I'm going to go have fun. I'm not going to drink. You are in serious danger when you come to that point, because not only are you spitting in the face of God who just saved you from all that stuff, but now you're turning your back on everything that saved you in the first place. Bad idea, all right? Perseverance, got to stick with it. Spirituality, I have to come back to my center of gravity every day and thank God for waking me up. God, thank you for waking me. You know, I did some things that were objectionable yesterday. You know, please forgive me for those things and teach me how to be better than that. Give me the strength I need to go make amends for those things. Or if I didn't do things that I thought were objectionable, I'd say, God, I know in some way, form, or fashion, I can be a better representative of you today than the one I was yesterday. So please help me see that. And then service to other people. I sponsor four different people. I have two sponsors of my own. One of them is heavy into the big book, and one of them is heavy into meditation and spirituality. So I use both of them at the same time, and they're best friends, but I want perspective. I want perspective on the whole program as a whole. So here I am, a Christian gentleman, a very happy individual, comfortable in his own skin, grateful to be standing in front of you, with nearly 7 years of sobriety, which is completely unheard of. And I want to thank you all for having me here today. God bless you. Thank you.